Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and again, happy Labor Day to you all. As we talk about early fall birding and the migration season, with two guests, Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County is the former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Noel, great to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry, and seems like all the storms here in eastern Wisconsin have passed out over Lake Michigan, but it was pretty hairy a while ago.
Oh, it was. Oh, Bill Volkert with us as well. Bill's a wildlife educator with the DNR. He's stationed in Horican Marsh. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Larry. Hi, Noel. How you doing?
Good, Bill.
Did you have that storm pass through the Horican area?
Oh, yeah. I woke up to it rumbling and pouring outside, so it was really coming down for a little bit.
Well, I tell you what, we have already getting some callers online. You can join in with your birding questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I took a look at this morning's Wisconsin State Journal, and right on the front page is a story about, it's titled A Conservation Success Story on Lower Wisconsin. And Bill, it talks about the DNR survey. I think Mike Mossman carried it out on the Lower Wisconsin State Riverway. And that riverway is really helping protect a lot of birds.
Well, it's an interesting corridor. It's, of course, the longest stretch of undammed river in the upper Midwest. And what's really important is the entire floodplain. So you not only have a very large river, but a continuous forest corridor running that whole stretch for 90 miles. And, of course, it's also a major migratory route. Birds coming up the Mississippi River branch off on that, or birds that are coming up from Illinois pick up on the Wisconsin, getting into central northern Wisconsin. And just to have that contiguous type of forest habitat is really important for wildlife movement. And we also find a number of birds that barely get into Wisconsin utilize those forests of the lower Wisconsin and the Mississippi River. So prothonotary warbler is certainly one where we don't see a lot of them in much of the state, but we've got a good distribution along those river corridors. And, of course, wintertime, a great place for bald eagles. We get some large concentration of eagles there. And where we're looking at real concerns over fragmented forests, this long string of continuous forest down that whole stretch is really important for lots of wildlife.
Yeah. The cerulean warbler is threatened in Wisconsin, but Mike found 50 in one flock.
And that's a bird of real concern. It's a forest interior bird, so they need large, mature forests. And, of course, we've got a real fragmentation of a lot of forests rather than the eastern hardwood forest as one big stand. It's smaller woodlots. That makes it much more difficult for those birds to survive in, higher nest losses and predation, and loss of habitat. And we don't know what's happening on the wintering ground, if that may be affecting survivorship of the birds. And it's not just Wisconsin, but a number of surrounding states have seen declines in cerulean warbler. And we're also, again, at the far northern edge of that bird's range. So they just barely get into Wisconsin, and we have seen declines here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Noel, how was your summer for bird watching or reports? Did you see any, were there any rare birds present in Wisconsin this summer that you noted?
Yeah, it seems like we always have some. One of the neatest things is that we had the first black-necked stilts nesting at Horicon in 1999, and this year there were at least three pairs that brought off young there. So people along the main dike especially really enjoyed watching the adults incubating. You could actually see where the birds were laying their eggs and then raising the young and watch them as they grew up to being young and matures. The other thing that was interesting is that our Kirtland's warbler population is expanding. You know, they just nested successfully for the first time in Wisconsin a couple of years ago. And this year there were 24 males and 13 females found. And personally, I guess the most neatest thing that I experienced this summer, while participating in a bird banding program at the River Ridge Nature Center in Ozaukee County, the first week we captured a male and female white-eyed vireo. And we proceeded to catch the male then several successive weeks after that. And this would only be the fifth successful documentation of breeding of this more southern species in Wisconsin.
Oh.
So it was, we kept hoping we'd catch a young fledged bird, but we never did. But catching the birds and hearing them sing around the nets where we were banding was really exciting this summer.
And that really is some good news. Let's take some calls here. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Joe in Oshkosh has a question for you guys, so let's go to Joe. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I've seen one eastern meadowlark in my entire life about 4 years ago. I looked it up. I thought, that's cool. And then I think I read somewhere or heard that they were a very popular bird in the state at one time. And I'm wondering if you know anything about that bird.
Bill, you want to start?
Well, both eastern and western meadowlarks have been showing declines across the United States. In Wisconsin, the western meadowlark has shown an even bigger decline. It tends to like a much shorter grass prairie. And what we have are really prairie birds, grassland birds, that have a stronghold out in the central prairie states. Wisconsin's in that eastern edge of their range. And what they did was to adapt from native grasslands to what we refer to as surrogate grasslands. Hay fields, pastures, fallowed fields, old fields, those types of environments. And, of course, it's just changes in the landscape itself that in land use patterns that have negatively affected these birds. Like a number of grassland birds, we've seen the change in agriculture from pasturing cattle to growing the hay crops and, of course, early harvest of the clovers, the alfalfas, that means we're now cutting during the nesting season, conversions of some of that land, development, or even abandonment of that and growing into brush and shrub or young forest. This has crowded the bird out. We have seen a bit of an uptick during the CRP period, so the Conservation Reserve set-aside program has certainly benefited the birds. But, yeah, they are birds that have overall, say, in the last 25 years, shown a decline. They're not as common around the state, but if you travel a little bit through the open farmland, you'll hear them sometimes singing out in the fields or perched up on the wires. They do fly down into the tropics, Mexico and in Central America for the wintertime. So here's a bird that may be hit on both ends even.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Joe. We have an email from Corrine. She says, I know this program's about fall birds. Actually, we talk about birds any type. We zero a little bit on fall birds. But she says, I've waited all summer for someone to tell me what kind of bird I have in one of our fields. It seems to be a kind of blackbird the size of a female redwing. It has a gold spot on the crown of its head and bold white marks on its back. Showed up about 4 years ago. It is in the same area every summer. I have been unable to find out what it is. Help.
I think we can do that one, Larry.
Yeah, I think so.
How about bobolink?
Yeah?
B-O-B-O-L-I-N-K. It's another neotropical migrant that overwinters down in South America. It comes back in early May, stays around through into July, late July, and they definitely nest in grasslands, hay fields, wherever there's pretty dense, low herbaceous vegetation. It's another species, like Bill was just discussing, with both the eastern and western meadowlarks, have declined significantly here in Wisconsin and throughout the upper Midwest. So it's a species that's really being looked a lot toward conservation and management activities in grasslands where they do occur. So it's a great bird to have show up on your property, and I hope they keep coming.
Yeah, me too. They're a pretty song.
One interesting thing about the bobolink is that, unlike most tropical migrants, they're not going down to the rainforest. They actually have to overshoot the entire Amazonian rainforest because they're a grassland bird. They go down to the grasslands, the pampas, and agricultural lands of Argentina.
Oh.
So an incredibly long flight.
Yeah.
So they have to overshoot the whole rainforest.
Oh, man. Well, that's...
That's exhausting, isn't it?
It makes me tired just thinking about it on this Labor Day. Oh, boy. Well, thanks for that email, Corrine. Yeah, now you have your answer. Let's turn to Lee in Jackson Park. Hi, Lee. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for calling.
First, I'd like to start off by saying I love listening to NPR, WPR. I listened to it before. It was cool. So thank you very much for the educational programming.
Thank you.
I have a more of a story to share. I lived in Wisconsin most of my life. I spent a lot of time in the Northern Woods area. I'm a Milwaukee boy. I am a city boy. I've been fortunate to do a lot of time up north in the woods. I was in California for a while. I just recently came back and back for about 2 years. I've noticed since I've been back, there's been a lot of hawks in the Milwaukee area. I'm not sure exactly what type of hawk it is. I live about 2 miles from Miller Park. I've noticed a lot over in that area. I did some work by Bayshore Mall. I've noticed a lot in that area. But the most interesting thing is about 5 days ago, sometime last week, I woke up early. I noticed a hawk eating a rabbit on my front lawn. Now, I do live across the street from Jackson Park, but it's still in the city. I'm not sure exactly what type of hawk it was. It was mostly golden color. It had like a black head, almost like a black mask. I guess if I did have a question, is there some sort of work being done to conserve these hawks? And would you know what type of hawk that is? Thank you for listening to my question. I will hang up and listen for an answer. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, well, I think either Bill or Noel. Noel, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I'll give it a shot here. Yeah, there's all raptors are protected, so I think that's very important to keep in mind. You cannot cause any kind of harm to them or to their well-being. So I think that educational message is getting out to more and more people as we go along. We still have raptors that are shot and trapped, but I think in general they're receiving pretty good stewardship these days and protection. And they are adapting, I think, to more urban habitats as those kind of habitats increase in number and are very often good sources of food, whether it's squirrels or chipmunks or rabbits or small rodents. So they're finding good sources of food. And I think, especially in the Milwaukee area, the three primary species you'll see, even though we do have things like peregrines that nest in Milwaukee area, the three dominant species would be the red-tailed hawk. They're probably the most likely raptor to prey upon a rabbit. American kestrels are smaller. They're primarily small rodent, small bird, dragonfly predators. And then we have Cooper's hawks, and that's the one that's really expanded greatly in number here in recent years, bouncing back from the pesticide era. I tell people there's probably a pair of Cooper's hawk nesting in every wooded park in the Milwaukee county system these days. And, of course, they're feeding primarily on birds, and, of course, with all the bird feeders and habitat in the urban areas for small songbirds, they're not having any problems with finding prey. So I think there's a lot of interest in raptors. You know, there's a lot of interest in watching them migrate, as some people did at the Forest Beach Migratory Preserve yesterday, where we had about 60 individuals migrating south already this fall. And with the habitats being there and the protection being offered and the prey, I expect to see good numbers, especially red tails and kestrels and Cooper's hawks in years to come.
Yeah, I would agree. And any comment from you, Bill?
No, I agree that those are the three that came to my mind as well. They're doing surprisingly well in the urban area. And with the park system, the forested areas, the open country, and we've mentioned this in previous programs, surprisingly, red-tailed hawk sitting right on the light posts on the freeway, the little median strip, or especially on the entrance ramps, that little bit of grass where there's a chance for a small rodent or rabbit. Amazing with all that traffic. It's still a hunting ground for them. And all you got to do is look up, and you'd be surprised just what you'll see sitting in the heavily urbanized areas.
And Lee mentioned Miller Park. When Old County Stadium was there, there was a red tail nesting on one of the light outfield light standards for a number of years.
We had a caller wondering if you guys are familiar with a sandhill crane refuge. She thinks is in Jackson Park, Indiana. Wonders if you have any information on it.
Jasper Pulaski Refuge.
Jasper Pulaski.
Yes, and it's a great place for watching cranes. They tend to host cranes almost the way that Horicon Marsh hosts Canada geese. We get, a lot more geese here, but 35,000 cranes are there. And we have two subspecies or different populations of sandhill cranes in the United States. the big population of what is the lesser sandhill crane, a slightly smaller bird, is coming up from Mexico and the southwestern states. That's the big crane festival on the Platte River at the end of March, and they're getting up into the Dakotas and through central Canada. That's their primary range. Our cranes are the greater sandhill cranes, so Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan populations, they go down to Jasper Pulaski Refuge. That's a staging area. That's where the individual breeding pairs and the smaller regional flocks now build up, and they will head south as far as southern Georgia, northern Florida is their range, and of course, depending on how severe or mild the winter is, anywhere from southern Indiana, Tennessee, and down toward Florida, they may scatter throughout there for the wintering sites.
Yeah, I should mention this is in northern Indiana. It's about 8,000 acres, and it's a great place to visit because they do have platforms that you can climb and watch the cranes. And as Bill said, you're talking about thousands of cranes stopping there.
Excellent. Talking birds and migration today with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Bill's with the Department of Natural Resources at Horicon Marsh. Noel, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at birds today with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, Larry Mueller here on this Labor Day. Thank you for listening in. Christian and Shano has a question for you guys, so let's go there. Hi, Christian.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for the call. Hey, I caught a bit of your program last week, and you were talking about herons possibly taking chipmunks.
Yes.
And we have a cottage outside of Anago, and the neighbor was referencing that they noticed the chipmunk population was down quite a bit. And I asked them if they had seen any herons around, and sure enough, they're out fishing, and they did see some. Would they be enough to take down a chipmunk population, or...
Well, I don't know. What do you think, Bill?
Well, it's not their primary food. And I think probably the reason that a heron taking a chipmunk makes a story is because this is really not their normal food. They're really going after fish and frogs, the larger aquatic life. They're a wading bird. But like any of the larger predators, they are opportunists. So if something presents itself, they won't hesitate. And I'm sure if you were to go through the literature and look at the diets and observations of these birds, most of it would be fish and frogs, but you'll find anecdotes of all kinds of things that these things have taken. Just, you're standing around waiting for your meal, and if something comes by, why not? I would say probably more likely the reason for a decline of chipmunks, I'd blame Cooper's hawks as a more likely one. That's something that they do prey on. Noel mentioned birds is a big part of the diet, but they will take chipmunks, and that's a possibility. Other predators could also be to blame for that. And there's always a chance, too, of among these rodent populations, even disease outbreak that could perhaps diminish the population.
Yeah, there you go.
But I wouldn't blame the heron. It's more of a noteworthy story just because he ate something that is normally way out of their normal diet.
Yeah, we did get quite a few calls from people who had observed herons eating chipmunks. It's probably a pretty easy meal for them when they go and stand stock still next to the bird feeder and grab the chipmunk. In fact, one caller, Scott Craven, actually mentioned that a former dean of our college, made several photographs of the heron taking the chipmunk and walking it down to the water and drowning it and then gobbling it up and then going back and getting another one.
Well, I think that's probably an unusual learned behavior.
Yeah.
Of one particular bird all of a sudden realizing here's an abundant, easy-to-catch food source. But I think the reason that this is so newsworthy, as I said, it's not typical.
Okay.
Yeah. But interesting what they'll eat.
Yeah. Bruce in Kenosha County, let's go to you now. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Talking about raptors, this is my favorite time of year because of the migration, and there's a osprey. I live on a lake. And I used to see the osprey stop in this time of year, and he'd hang out. There were a couple of really great trees for him to roost on. And I haven't seen him lately, but we saw one on the way to work the other day.
Very cool.
Don't they nest in Canada?
Well, they nest in Wisconsin, and as well as Canada. It's a species that's, like the bald eagle, are continuing to increase in number of nest sites in the state. We now have them nesting in several counties here in the southern part of the state, and it's wonderful to see them bouncing back also from the days when they were just greatly reduced in number. It's interesting that this is, and we talked about bobolinks migrating all the way to Argentina. Ospreys nest are here in Wisconsin, of course, but then they migrate out of Wisconsin and head for the tropics also. And they will spend their first year, the young birds will spend their first year in Central America, Northern, South America. They don't return the following spring typically, and it takes them a couple years to return. So, again, like some of our small songbirds, these large birds also have a pretty long migration journey to between their wintering grounds and their breeding grounds here in this area.
And the osprey has done well enough in Wisconsin that in the past year or so we've taken them off the threatened species list, so they're considered a recovered population.
Very cool.
So it's not just Canada.
Thanks, Bruce.
Yeah.
Appreciate the call. Again, you can join us. We have some open lines at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. We had an email list, by the way, as well, at talk@wpr.org. We had a caller ask, how tall do herons get?
Probably about 4 feet.
4 feet, I would say.
Yeah, roughly that. Yeah, you know, if you see them standing in water among the reeds, or if their neck is bent and hunkered down a little bit, you know, that height sort of changes because, you know, there's an awful lot of neck there.
Of course, we're talking about the great blue heron.
Right.
Yeah. The other common heron that we have is the green heron. It's noticeably smaller. Maybe stretched full height, it maybe only reach a foot and a half to 2 feet.
Yeah, roughly the size of a crow.
Right.
I'm really pleased at the number of great blue herons that are spending their entire summer in the Madison area. We've had herons. I've got a couple that'll come and fish right off my pier. And we see them all the time, and it's really a pleasure, because for years it was a rare sight to see a great blue heron on Lake Monona, for example.
Well, they are colonial nesters, so if you have a nesting colony establish itself nearby during the early midsummer, the adults are flying out to feeding areas to feed the young, and once we get to about early July, the nesting season's over, and now they disperse. And for those people who live near water, where you may not see them coming to a feeding site from a nearby colony, all of a sudden now they're scattering out for the end of summer, and the adults and young are fattening up, feeding, and they're visiting new areas at this point.
And some of these colonies exist for decades. Others, they seem to move a little bit more frequently. But overall, I think around the Wisconsin, there's probably a colony or so-called rookery in just about every county in the state.
Yeah, that's great. We had an email from Kitty. She said, we've enjoyed lots of orioles in the Arena, Wisconsin area this year, but notice they stopped singing for a while, then they started up again. Is there something called second song?
Well, what you have is really the aggressive singing in springtime is to establish a territory, making a land claim for yourself, keeping the other males out, and luring in a female. So they're very noisy when they first arrive. There's that sort of excitement getting into a new nesting season. Once they start to tend the young, now they want to be a little more quiet and not draw the attention to it, and you'll hear more of the calls, the single notes and chatters that they make, so that diagnostic song tends to disappear. And in late summer, we'll hear a little bit of singing. It's not as aggressive and frequent as in spring, and some of this is perhaps the adults as well as young ones sort of practicing. And you'll also will hear that as we get into now the preparation for migration, and orioles are getting ready to head out, if they aren't already departing at this point, the hormone changes that take place that stimulate migration will oftentimes trigger a little bit of singing. And I sometimes wonder if it isn't even the young ones that are practicing a song to get a little bit of a feedback of their own song and what they've heard from the adults in preparation perhaps for next spring.
Yeah.
But it's not, say, triggered for mate selection, territorial defense. So it's different than in spring, and that's why it's certainly not as aggressive.
We have four, maybe five young orioles coming to our feeders yet, and then a couple of...
Still, good for you.
Yeah, and a couple of adults. And so it's it's great still every morning.
They're gonna be packing up pretty soon, Larry.
Yeah, every morning they're out there, and usually then late in the afternoon they come back.
Well, you're lucky to have them at a feeder. First of all, this late in the year when there's just such an abundance of natural food, they've obviously got a habit of the offerings you have. But the other nice thing is that fall migration is so hard for us to observe because the birds are not singing. They're under a lot of cover. The leaves are so thick. And they just secretly seem to just silently disappear. But you'll be able to observe when all of a sudden they're not coming to the feeders anymore. And, of course, you may even have the attraction of those birds at the feeder, maybe even luring in migrants that are passing through the area as well.
Yeah.
And the pace during fall is much slower, too. There's a press in the springtime for the birds to get back to their breeding ground. So it's a much more hurried, much more noticeable event. And as Bill mentioned, a lot of times they're coming through without much vegetation around and they're singing. This time of year, it's a much more leisurely pace. They're not moving as far on a day. It's just a different type of movement than in the springtime.
Also, for observations, it is so obvious and very apparent in springtime. The leaves aren't out, and that very first songbird shows up, the first migrant of the year of any species. Everybody knows, if you're watching at all, when they show up. But fall time is really hard to pick when they all disappear.
Yeah.
As they're concealed, they just disappear somewhat silently. And even if you're keeping track every day, you almost have to go back in your records and say, it's been 2 weeks since I've seen any of these. They must have pulled out way back then.
Yeah. Well, William in Colfax has a question for you guys, so let's go to William. Hi, William.
Hi. I just was saying that I observed lots of ospreys in the urban areas, which I thought was interesting. There was one that nests on a cell phone tower in downtown Menominee, Wisconsin. They don't seem to, and it's right next to the river there, but... and in Eau Claire, there's a nesting osprey on the light posts in center field at Carson Park. You know, they fly around when there's baseball games going on, or they hunt the river in front of the farmer's market. So it's great to see them. The other thing I was wondering about is how the peregrine falcons were doing.
How are the peregrine falcons doing?
They did wonderful this year. I have a report. If people want to look at my email that's on your website, Larry,
yeah.
I can send them a year-end summary of what happened to peregrines this year. It talks about how many were raised at different locations around the state. It's about a 30-page report, so I can email that to folks if they're interested. But continuing the trend we've seen in recent years, they're doing quite well, not only along the Lake Michigan shoreline, but birds nesting inland along the Wisconsin River, along the Fox River up in the Fox Valley, and along the Mississippi. So, and I expect this trend to continue. You know, slowly but surely, we'll see the populations coming back, even though many of the ones that are still nesting depend upon humans to provide boxes for them and keep them clean and safe. So they're still somewhat managed quite strongly by our involvement with them, but they're doing nicely in it. Been getting reports out in the Columbia, Dane County area, them feeding on shorebirds. And, of course, they did nest there in Madison again on the power plant, at Madison Gas and Electric's power plant.
Very cool. Thanks again for calling. Megan in Bessemer, Michigan, we're on to you now. Hi, Megan.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, thank you very much. Well, I'm a pilot actually out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm up here going to school in Ironwood. But my question was... as a pilot, I've noticed a lot of airports will shoot birds. They buy a license, and they will shoot birds that land on the runway. And one bird in particular that I've seen shot quite often is the sandhill crane. Pretty bad.
Well,
most major airports actually have somebody there for deterring the birds. The real problem for pilots is takeoff and landing. You know, birds don't fly as high as most planes do, but we do kind of intercept their airspace as planes are going up and coming down. And when you have an airport, large open area, a lot of grass is maintained out there, there are some birds that are attracted to it. Canada geese, gulls, even some of the grassland birds certainly are, but those larger birds are the real hazards for airplanes. And so Wildlife Services... this is a federal agency, they oftentimes have staff at the major airports. The first thing is deterrence. How can we just keep them from coming there? And there's a number of techniques they've tried to basically scare the birds away from there, what's really an attractive area for a lot of the birds. And they do have, under federal permit, they are allowed to take some birds, but that's always absolute last resort. And these are, say, an individual that you just can't train any other way that just seems to be have a liking for it. And, of course, as flocking birds, the real concern is if you get a couple of them that hang around, they oftentimes decoy others, and they just see that it's a comfortable area, and now we create a nuisance level. So there's a lot of deterrence that goes on to try to keep those birds away from those open spaces, and that's a major effort.
Okay. Thanks, Megan, for calling. Appreciate your call. Tom and Cashton, we're on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I have a question for Dr. Cutright.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in looking birds up in the index of your book on breeding birds in Wisconsin, it's been, for me, kind of frustrating because I'll look up a meadowlark and I won't find an entry. I have to know that it's either an eastern or a western meadowlark. And even the goldfinch, which there's only one species in the state, I have to know that it's the American goldfinch. To me, it's like almost looking up. And similar for sparrows. To me, it's almost like looking up people in the phone book by their first names rather than their last. I'd like a little bit of an explanation as to your motivation for the indexing procedure.
Okay. Noel?
Well, they do have, you know, official common names, and that's what birders and ornithologists try to make sure, so there's no confusion of them. But If you look up goldfinch, you have to look under American, as you say, and there's a lot of pages listed there. It's just the way that indexing is done in the ornithological world, you know, based upon the American Ornithologist Union checklist. And, you know, it's easy for a bird like bobolink because you only have one word to look up. But, yes, you'd have to know the entire name to find a black-capped chickadee. You wouldn't be able to go up and just look in chickadee. This is pretty standard format, and I'm sorry that you have trouble finding some of the species, but it's just following pretty much standard protocol on how to index these species.
There you go. Let's go to Marilyn and Ellison Bay next. Hi, thank you for calling, Marilyn.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have an issue, which is not specifically mine, but I think it's definitely Door County, and it's probably other places in Wisconsin as well, because I am part of the Bluebird Restoration Association in the state, and
yeah.
I've been monitoring bluebird boxes at Newport State Park for the past 6 years. And my problem this year is house wrens. They have just really taken over, especially second brood time period. In my experience this year, I had more bluebirds killed by wrens than had fledged, which is just a horrible record. My first couple years, no house wrens whatsoever. 2 years ago, they started coming in, but that was more or less a habitat thing. I was able to move those boxes off to more open areas and, you know, kind of resolve that problem. But now we're not even talking the traditional house wren habitat of brushy and, you know, more closed areas. They're just everywhere, and they're causing a lot of destruction. And I wondered if either one of you would have any strategies for addressing that.
Okay, somebody want to, Bill, you want to try them in first?
Yeah, my first suggestion would have been moving the boxes
right
further away from shrubs and heavy cover, because that really is what the house wren tends to prefer, where the bluebird's more in the open. But if I understood, you said even moving them out right in the open at the house wrens are even finding and utilizing them there. That's usually a good solution for it. Otherwise, yeah, I do know that house wrens certainly can be aggressive and will go into those other boxes and try to pip the eggs or even kill the young. They can be aggressive little things, and there can be problems. You know, house wrens are tropical migrants, and they are fairly adaptable. They're doing quite well, apparently, at least for you, at the expense of the bluebirds. Usually in eastern Wisconsin, it's more the competition for the nest site with the tree swallow.
Right.
Kind of a unique situation. Do you have enough big open area to keep a sufficient number of boxes?
Well, I do. I use primarily a big open meadow space at Newport State
Park. And even right in the wide open, the house wrens are going that far?
Yes, they are.
That's an odd habit for them.
And I also, I do have the tree swallows, but I don't consider them the aggressive problem that these house wrens are.
Well, they're aggressive only in terms of trying to occupy the house, but they will not, like the house wren, go to an adjacent house and actually try to pip the eggs to puncture it or kill the young in the box to reduce competition.
And that all of the above happened this year, including they built nests right over young hatchlings.
No,
they'll do that.
Yeah, for such a little bird, they're a little feisty thing, aren't they?
They are.
Yeah.
I wish we had an answer for you, Mary Lynn.
Yeah, my suggestion would have been move them into the wide open. That usually deters them, but obviously you've got some pretty adaptable little house wrens there.
Well, I think that perhaps their population is increasing to such an extent that maybe they're more generalists than we might have thought they were.
Well, I'm guessing that's what's happened. It's probably there's better habitat there now. Things are growing up. Maybe they're not doing as much opening up of habitats. There's more shrubland, brushland available, and the population has risen to the point where house wrens are more willing, I guess, to expand their areas where they're willing to nest and therefore invading into more natural opening-type situations.
Right. I agree. It seems like that's the case, and I wish that the sequel to that was how do we
do you have an increasing amount of shrub invasion around the fields? That maybe some shrub management to try to keep that as a larger, more open aspect might help?
Well, you know, Newport State Park is the state's first and I believe at this point only wilderness park.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Management is pretty slim on changing habitat.
The other question I would have is how localized of a situation is. You've got a pretty good bluebird population in the central portion of the Door County Peninsula, some of that open area.
Right.
Are they experiencing anywhere near the situation you are, or is this very localized just to Newport?
No, it's all of Door County. I talked to Charlotte Lucas, our county coordinator, just yesterday, and she said, you know, everybody's experiencing more of the house wren problem.
Boy, that's too bad.
Yeah, well, you know, they're birds, too.
Yeah, they're birds, too.
But I will have to say that if you look at the 20-year trend on bluebirds and what we've done for them in Wisconsin, even with this kind of localized house wren competition right now, bluebirds have really come back. They've done extremely well, and the Bluebird Restoration Association has done a great job to coordinate a lot of that effort among the bluebird enthusiasts. So we've really benefited them when you look at the big picture, even if you've got a kind of a localized problem there right now.
Right.
Yeah, last year the Bluebird Restoration Association documented over 28,000 bluebirds have fledged in 2009. So
exactly, and Cantal is hoping to get to 30,000.
Absolutely, that's his number. He's going for it. Knowing Kent, he'll get there.
Yes, I hope he does.
Of course, the next goal then is 50,000. Why not? It's a nice round number.
Thanks, Mary Lynn.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your call very much. Oh boy. Problems sometimes and opportunities. One bird comes on a little stronger, like the bluebird, and then another bird finds some opportunities. So that's nature sometimes. Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, our guests today, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking birds and fall migration today with Noel Cutright of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, Bill Volkert of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources based in Horican Marsh. Glad to have them both with us and certainly inviting your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Someone was wondering, Bill, about the population of Canada geese at Horican right now.
Well, we're still a little early for the true migration. Normally, the 15th to the 20th of September is when the geese start coming down from Canada. So what we're seeing right now are the giant Canada geese, that local nesting population, and they, of course, have fledged young. They've been capable of flying for the last month plus, and they're starting to flock up and move around. But it's getting a little harder to determine just when the migrants come in, just because we've got a good population of geese. When I started here, when you saw the first flocks of geese actually showing up in the marsh, you know those are migrants. But now with the local population gathering around here in good numbers, unless we happen to get a good cold front and see them actually coming in, it isn't until we get to late September we notice numbers building up. And the peak tends to be middle to late October. And if anybody is planning a trip to Horican Marsh to enjoy the fall migration, I usually suggest middle to late October. We're not normally at peak numbers, but we are at the peak of fall. Fall colors, lots of other birds are out there, a goose population of at least 100 to 150,000 by that time of the year. As we get to the end of October, early November, we'll be around 200,000 geese. Plenty of geese as you get in November, but not much of anything else.
Shane in Lancaster, on to you now. Hi, Shane.
Good morning. How are you, gentlemen?
Good.
Good. Say, I've got a question and observation about nighthawks or mosquito hawks. My observation is, you know, you hear them at night, and if you're lucky, you might spot one at dusk or dawn, or if they happen to fly into the outdoor lighting of a building. But this past week on my commute home, I observed literally hundreds, probably a couple hundred, swarming over a golf course, and I presumed they were feeding, but I've never seen them flock together like that and as well be visible, so visible during daylight hours.
No, just before
dusk? Have you seen that before? Any comments on that?
Well, I think you really hit the peak of migration. We started seeing reports in northern Wisconsin of people seeing nighthawks 2 to 3 weeks ago, and this past week, especially in the southern third of Wisconsin, we've been a lot of people reporting, you know, sizable numbers of nighthawks. I know there was one fellow in the Milwaukee area, counted over 210 minutes passing overhead. So
wow.
Some of these birds will be flocking in areas where they can catch a lot of insects and more or less just accumulate in a large swarm. Others will just be catching insects as they can fly and move south, and they'll be pretty much streaming in a southern movement. But common nighthawks is a species that's really declining a lot in Wisconsin. They used to nest on tops of rooftops in downtown Milwaukee and many of our small towns and villages and communities in Wisconsin. But for some reason, whether it's increased crow populations, gull populations, changes in roof structure, because we're seeing changes of gravel-top rooftops over to more rubber type, whether it's changes in the habitat in the Barrens areas in northern Wisconsin where they typically nested in native habitat, we're really not sure what's contributing. There may be a combination of reasons, but the numbers of nighthawks are certainly declining. It seems like in the spring it's hard to see them, but right now is a peak time to see these birds moving from the northern part of the state and out of Canada toward the tropics where they'll be spending the winter. So it was great that you were able to find such a concentration, and if they were just moving around a lot in more or less one area, I'm sure they were catching. There's been a lot of insect hatches, dragonflies have been moving in recent weeks, and I'm sure they were kind of in a feeding frenzy there for a while.
That is one bird that you can actually observe a migration.
Yes.
Just before dark, you see that swarming. The last 2 weeks of August into the first week of September, that's the movement, and now more or less they're gone and heading down to the tropics.
Yep. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Oops, sorry here. Let's go to Shane. Are you still there?
Yeah, I am. The other question I had about, and I'm sorry I didn't bring it up, is there some population pressure on red-winged blackbirds? Because I've been a cyclist for many years, and, you know, you'd come across nesting areas of red wings, and they may squawk at you. But in the past 2-3 years, the aggressive behavior of them as you pass by their nesting areas is, you know, markedly increased. They're not just squawking, not just taking swings by, but actually making contact with you as a cyclist. So is there some underlying population pressure, nesting pressure, that's creating that?
Well, they're doing quite well as a population. They can be a bit of an agricultural pest, and there have been programs to try to reduce populations locally and address some of that. I think, really, they are an aggressive bird around their nesting territory, and if you've got a nest nearby a roadside, they can get quite aggressive. And I think it's probably, say, rather than the overall population, a couple of individuals that just have an attitude, and if there's a nest close enough to a road, they will drive anything out of the area. We'll see them chasing after crows, red-tailed hawks, and birds many times their size. They're feisty little things, and they will defend that nest. And so if that nest is anywhere near where people are passing by, those birds can get aggressive.
I think decades ago, you know, they were pretty restricted to wetland-type habitats, especially cattails, but now we've seen them expanding into shrublands, you know, dogwood thickets and pastures and haylands. Overall, the population actually has declined a little bit over the last few years. They're down to about 1 to 2% decline per year over the last 30 years here in Wisconsin. So their total numbers are actually going down, but I think their plasticity on where they put nests and therefore encountering people along roadsides has probably increased.
And also where you've seen a recent decrease of the population in the last 30 years, I think we probably also saw a tremendous increase with changes of agriculture,
right,
providing just an endless food supply for them.
Yeah.
So we created an artificial situation.
There you go, Shane. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Bob in Lake Geneva. Bob, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a small cabin on Washington Island that overlooks Hog Island. And I wondered about the cormorant population. It just seems to be expanding. And 20, 25 years ago, there were tall trees on Hog Island. And since there's so many cormorants, I understand, on the island, it's changed. And all the large trees have died. There's just shrubs there now.
Any comments?
Sure. I can start with that. Noel can jump in. Cormorants are an interesting bird in that, first of all, they're somewhat distant relatives to the pelicans, and the double-crested cormorant is really one of the few species of cormorants that nests in inland areas. Most of them around the world, the different species are associated with coastal brackish water. But our cormorant was on the endangered list in Wisconsin through the 1970s. Into the 80s, we downlisted it to threatened species. I believe that was 82 and 88. If my memory serves me right, it was the first animal taken off of the threatened species list and considered fully recovered. So it was the contaminants in the food chain that certainly knocked them down through the 60s and the 70s. They've made a great comeback, and to the point where they were now providing in the last, say, 10, 15 years, serious competition with commercial fishermen. And also these nuisance problems that when they get into a site of trees and start nesting, they will just burn them out. I don't know what it is about their diet that just seems to devastate trees. And so you have an aesthetic concern of burning out these trees in the nesting colonies, Lake Winnebago into Green Bay and around the Lake Michigan shore. We've seen that. And also, under federal permit, they have been allowed to reduce the population a bit, just simply because there is competition with commercial fishing. So here's a bird that 25, 30 years ago, we were trying to get off the endangered list and has now come back so well that it's a localized nuisance problem. It does show the resiliency of birds, that if we can do something to improve the quality of the environment, they can come back, they can respond. And we know that most of the reasons for endangerment is human-caused. We can also help them to turn around. But, of course, as we tend to kind of bump into birds and crowd them a little bit, we oftentimes see some of the successes being to the point of nuisance. Look at Canada geese. The local nesting population, the giant Canada goose, we thought was extinct by the 50s. And now they're a nuisance problem in golf courses and cities. So some of these birds have come back and almost done too well.
There's an excellent article in the Wisconsin Natural Resources magazine for February 2008 called Cormorant Conundrum, and that's really what it is, as Bill has explained. But Jeff Pritzel and his co-author talks a good history and how we now have approaching 15,000 nests and where they're and the problems that it's posing for managers of habitat of islands. And of course, it's also become controversial in the fishery industry in Wisconsin. But the February 2008 Natural Resources magazine, you can find it online, does a nice job of summarizing kind of where we've been with cormorants and where we may be heading.
Thanks for calling, Bob. Appreciate your call. I did hear there was was there a disease outbreak among cormorants here recently?
Newcastle. Yes. And that's an incredibly virulent disease. It's normally been restricted to western states and into the Dakotas, and it can get into some of these colonial nesting birds, and cormorants seem to be one of them. It's a pretty hot disease. It's one of these things that can really get to an epidemic level. This may be one of the first occurrences of this in the upper Midwest. Mm. So, yeah, it's being watched closely. And, of course, I suppose maybe that's nature's way of controlling a bird population that's been incredibly successful as well.
Yeah, there was a virulent strain detected in about 1,000 gulls and 500 cormorants in Minnesota. And even though they picked up a few cormorants, apparently, in Door County, it doesn't appear that they were infected with this virulent strain. So
No. We
may be escape this one. But as Bill says, as populations build, as diseases mutate and change, it's certainly one of nature's ways of taking, controlling or dealing with populations that have gotten extremely high.
Gloria in Waukesha County, hello to you.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I live in the middle of Waukesha County, and I've lived here for more than 10 years. And in the last two summers, I've noticed a new bird, like a hawk, but much bigger than the normal hawks that we have here, gliding and soaring over the fields. And I'm thinking, it's very dark, and I'm thinking, that couldn't be a turkey vulture, could it?
Sure.
It sure could.
Okay, because don't they only eat dead things?
They typically only nest in or feed on carrion. You are correct. The black vulture, which is a more southern species, is a little bit predaceous, but our turkey vulture is entirely feeds on carrion, but they also feed on vegetable matter. The captive turkey vulture at the Schlitz Audubon Center in Milwaukee, they feed the pumpkins and all different kinds of vegetation. And you look at the diet, they actually feed a whole lot more on vegetation than what normally one would expect, but from an animal matter, yes, it would be carrion.
Yeah, and you're it's got to be a turkey vulture, almost assuredly. Our guests today, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, they'll be with us until 12:30 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us on this Labor Day. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, our birding experts, talking about birds, migration, and certainly inviting your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234 or through email at talk@wpr.org. Bob in Portage County is up next. Bob, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hey, good morning, guys, or good afternoon. This is just such a great forum. I want to thank you guys for taking your time on Labor Day and doing this.
We enjoy it.
Always look forward to this show.
Thank you.
Two quick comments and then a question for you. The cormorants, I think, are killing the trees off at real high nitrogen in their diet, the fish, and it concentrates, and the nitrogen kills the tree roots. The other thing is we've had the same problem with wrens here. We're smack in the middle of the state, and the wren took the bluebird house in the middle of a 10-acre field and actually didn't nest in the houses that we put on the edge of the field for them. So there actually might be a behavior change here, something to watch.
Hmm.
Okay, the third one, the real point here is we feed sunflowers in the winter, I think, like most of the people in the state do, and I think that's great. But I've heard that they're poisoning the birds in the Dakotas so that they can grow the sunflowers that we feed here to keep the birds alive. Is this all turning into a zero-sum game?
Oh. Well, Noel, have you heard anything of that?
I do know that predation, if you want to call it that, feeding on sunflowers is certainly a major problem in certain areas of the Dakotas where they raise most of our sunflowers. So I do know that there has been some campaigns to receive permission to do chemicals to prevent that. I don't know the extent of it, and I guess I haven't read anything here recently in the last year or two of how prominent it is or how widespread it is, but it is definitely a concern for sunflower growers that the birds are taking more than they are. So it's something that we need to pay attention to, I guess, and be aware of. But I don't have any really recent information. I don't know if you've heard anything recently, Bill, or not.
No, I haven't, but a lot of times the depredation concerns on those types of crops, just like with corn, is the red-winged blackbirds.
Right.
So these late summer, fall concentrations of blackbird flocks that are hitting it. And usually what they use is a chemical called Avitrol. And it is a poison, and it is under federal permit. And what they do is they've got a very small amount of it in the total amount of feed out there. And it's not meant to kill every single bird, but in a sense to kill a few of them and sort of send a signal to a couple of the others as an unsuitable area. And so, you know, we're really creating artificial situations, a bait pile by growing these crops.
Yeah.
The birds come in, you can't blame them. They're causing depredation before harvest. And, of course, the red-winged blackbird is an extremely successful large population, which really what we're seeing, you know, is what we're feeding is a whole different group of birds for the wintertime. So it's not that we're killing in large numbers the birds that we're also trying to feed in the wintertime. They are different species. And, again, the campaign would not be to, say, kill every single red-winged blackbird out in these areas either, but more as a deterrent to try to scatter that flock and keep them out of there before harvest.
There you go. Let's go to, thank you for that call. Phil in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you. Thank you for calling and waiting. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon, fellas. I'm wondering about the passenger pigeon's extinction.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't able to call through to the show last week, but I did have an experience this summer out in Wyoming where I did see a passenger pigeon. Now, what are the odds of that?
Zero.
Zero?
Zero. The last bird died in the Cincinnati Zoo named Martha in 1914, so they've been gone for almost a century.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know what the passenger pigeon is and the mourning dove. This was definitely way bigger than a mourning dove.
Well, there are a number of other dove species
in
the United States. Yeah.
Okay.
So if you take a look in your field guide, Wisconsin, we've got really the mourning dove is our only true wild dove of any real numbers, and of course the rock pigeon or common pigeon, an introduced bird. But if, you know, there's a huge family of pigeons and doves around the world, and as you get into the southern and western states, you're going to find a greater variety of them. So the passenger pigeon, though, is one of the great extinction stories, and I've always said I think that loss of that bird was what initiated the entire conservation movement for North America. It was considered to have been the most abundant bird to have ever nested in North America, and a bird that looked to be so incredibly abundant, we didn't think that we could even put a dent in the population. I think it shocked the world that we literally wiped them out. The biggest nesting ever be recorded was in Wisconsin in 1871, an estimated 136 million birds nested across western and central Wisconsin in one big colony. And it was September 1st, 1899, and we're talking only 28 years later, the last bird was shot in the Wisconsin Rapids, Babcock area. And so this was an incredible fast demise. It was unregulated hunting. You also had the railroads and now telegraph service. In other words, these big nesting colonies people knew about instantly. And so we didn't just shoot every last one, but there was constant disruption. We kept clubbing the young, shaking the birds out of the trees, shooting the adults for the market. So they probably didn't even successfully nest for a number of years. We don't know if we brought in diseases with the common pigeon that may have affected it. Timbering and loss of the mass crops in the forests, all of these contributed to the demise of the bird. And I've always felt that it must have been in the awakening of the American consciousness that if we could wipe out a bird as abundant as a passenger pigeon, nothing else stood a chance unless we really had a conscious effort for conservation. And while it was an incredible loss, and we'll never see it again, and it was an ornithology story that is just unbelievable, the numbers of birds that people used to observe and we never will, it at least, I think, contributed to conservation effort that saved a lot of other species, realizing if we could lose them, we could lose any of them.
Yeah.
And we've been working, you know, for 100 years to bring a lot of things back.
Yeah, I agree with Bill that, you know, some of the estimates go to 3 to 5 billion, and they constituted, you know, 25 to maybe 40% of the total birds in the United States were passenger pigeons. The bird he may have observed out west is a Eurasian collared dove. That's a rather new introduction into the United States, and we have them now breeding here in Wisconsin, but they're spreading toward the northwest. They look somewhat like a mourning dove, but are a little bit larger, do have a collar around the back of their neck, so that might have been the bird that Phil saw.
All right. There you go, Phil. Thank you for calling. Jerry and Jackson, let's go to you next. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I've got a problem with my barn swallows. They did not come back this year, and I see during the whole summer, I'd see them coming in and out, but they had no nest. And I was wondering, since it's full of old nests, would it be helpful if I knocked them down to bring them back?
If they're located on, you know, you're probably talking about a barn or a shed of some kind?
Right, in my barn.
And they're nesting on the rafters. And some of those might have little protrusions or something that helps them select those most favorable sites to anchor their mud nest.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be a problem at all to go ahead and remove those. You might open up some of the sites on those timbers that would be more conducive for them to anchor their nest, too. So I would go ahead and do it.
Okay.
Yeah. There
great.
You go.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for calling. And Ann in Madison, you're next. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Well, this is an interesting program, and if this were Shangri-La, everybody would either be educated to understand or would automatically understand that all parts of our ecosystem on planet Earth are connected. And when you destroy one part, you're actually lessening your own chances of thriving. And I wondered whether there was any cooperation between some of the organizations representing the forces that have destroyed habitat, and that includes so many, like industrial toxic chemical dumping in the waterways and factory farming and developers who seem to just gobble up land without any interest in what they're displacing, and groups like ornithologists who are trying to preserve habitat. It often seems as if, you know, these groups are attacked almost by huge associations and dismissed as being anti-job. And it's too bad that, you know, that human beings and preservation have to be misleadingly, you know, depicted as opposites.
Well, let's get a comment from...
I can start with that.
Yeah,
and
go ahead,
Bill. Jump in, too. First of all, I guess I would have to say if I could, you know, get everybody to appreciate birds, I think that'd be a great start. And one thing I think is really nice about bird watching is it not only opens you up to a discovery of the wildlife that's around us, and, you know, they're certainly very widespread and incredibly diverse, but birds are just the most visible part of our animal world. And so it is a way, as a kind of a door, to get people interested in not only wildlife, the beauty that we see in nature, but also the environmental issues, the concerns for different birds, especially those in peril. As far as trying to bring everybody into the loop, I wish I could turn everybody into a bird watcher and bird lover. We really have two approaches that we try to take. One is education and public information. And as DNR, we always have as a backup a regulatory a process as well. So when it comes to industry and dumping, yes, there are a lot of rules and regulations. We try to work with industry to reduce, first of all, the use of toxic chemicals and regulate their disposal. So we try to at least keep that out of the environment. There also have been initiatives where we're trying to bring certain people into conservation efforts. 1985 was the first time that the Federal Farm Bill actually provided for conservation provisions through the CRP set-aside, 10-year set-aside to create wildlife habitats of land that was not being farmed. We have certainly depend on for financial resources for certain projects, industry as supporters, and even industry or agriculture with their land to try to work a little bit as compatible uses for conservation efforts. So there are certainly those kinds of collaborations. We look at the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. We've got lots of people who've signed on, and it's not just all the ornithologists, the bird clubs, and the sportsmen. We're trying to get a lot of other organizations and cross-sections of the public involved in this. We're also trying to initiate a bird city project, so we're trying to make some of our cities more bird-friendly. So there are efforts always to try to bring people into the fold. And I think as a philosophy and as a goal, I think we're all further ahead if we can work together toward common goals. And rather than seeing, say, conservation versus industry and jobs, I think we can find that if we can make a more sustainable environment, we can have a compatibility. And there's more than enough proof that things that we do that are good for conservation and good for the health of the environment are also good for the economy and good for people. That was the same fear we heard about the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, that we're going to shut everybody down. Here we are 25 years later. Business is still going, and, hey, our water's a lot cleaner.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Lauren, and that it has to do with the red-tailed hawk, seeing more red tails in suburban and urban areas this summer even than in previous ones. And Lauren said one factor contributing to that is a low in the meadow vole cycle this year. Statewide field work by UW-Stevens Point grad student Ryan Stevens in 2009 and 2010 has shown that the meadow vole, a primary food source for red tails, is quite scarce this year. So redtails may be crowding into more urban areas where the gray squirrels, the 13-line ground squirrels, and the chipmunks, and the cottontails, and the white-footed mice are there and offer an alternative food source.
Well, I think that's insightful. The meadow vole is probably the one rodent that is preyed upon by more raptors than any other species we have. So there's no question when their population cycles are down, birds are going to have to search for other prey to use. And around my house, I know it's been a very good rabbit year this year, so maybe the rabbit population's up in general. And as you mentioned, 13-line ground squirrels and chipmunks and other smaller mammals may be up a little bit this year, which provides an additional source for them, and they're learning to find food in more urbanized areas of the state. So I think there's a lot of what Warren says is true.
The meadow vole has a 4 to 5 year population cycle, normally 4 years. Keeps climbing and climbing, just like lemmings, and then they bust. And so that does affect wildlife food availability.
Another email from Bonnie in Madison. She says, I know that some whooping cranes, I'm not sure if they are Wisconsin whooping cranes, overwinter off the Texas Gulf Coast. What about the Gulf oil spill and its effect on the areas where the cranes stay? You guys, either of you know?
Well, that's the wood buffalo or Rance's flock, not the Wisconsin flock. We're training our flock to go to Florida, and the main reason is so we can have two distinctly separate populations just in case some natural or human-caused disaster may affect the one remaining wild population. The good news is that big oil gusher out there was to the east of the Texas coast, and the way the winds and currents are going, it was moving more up toward Alabama over to Florida, not back to Texas. But it does show the real vulnerability when we have, kind of like putting all your eggs in one basket. We've got a threatened or now an endangered population of birds remaining in one major wild flock, and what happens if something disastrous happens right there on the wintering grounds or their nesting grounds for any of those populations. That compounds all of our conservation efforts.
And our sandhill cranes that breed here in Wisconsin head for the southeast. They head for Florida or stop short of reaching Florida. Those that would nest along the Gulf Coast are not that abundant. Most of the inland sandhill crane population overwinters farther north off the coast in West Texas and in New Mexico. So I don't think the sandhills, wintering population of the sandhills are going to be threatened at all by the oil situation in the Gulf.
Okay, then we had Lisa in Sheboygan who saw this morning a male cardinal feeding another, which looked like a female or perhaps immature male. I know I see them all winter. Do any of them migrate, and is it unusual for birds to have young this late in the season?
There are still youngsters around. I know that a friend had an active bluebird nest here a week ago. And there's birds that still will solicit food from the adults. And in the springtime, certain birds also, the male will feed the female. So he might have been a especially enamorous male here that wanted to establish a bond with a female, or it could have been a young bird. The female cardinal looks very much like the immature cardinals before the males really establish their bright plumage. So it could have been either one, but it's not that surprising to see either a female or a young bird being fed this late in the year.
And cardinals do not migrate.
Right.
Right. Kimberly lives between Cambridge and Jefferson and had a male bobwhite late this past week in Kimberly's area. And the first time they'd had one there. What about the population of bobwhite?
Well, we're at the far northern edge, so they barely get into Wisconsin. Our stronghold is in the southwestern part of the state, west of Madison, over toward the Mississippi River. DNR, a number of years ago, had a special program in Richland County area trying to increase the population. It's been a real struggle. We're kind of far north. Hard winters can really have an impact. And when you get these scattered sightings, a little hard to say sometimes whether or not this is from the wild population. They are also kept by the gamekeepers. And so there could be an escapee from a game farm, too. That's always a possibility. So
that's what we usually have in southeastern Wisconsin are our escapees. But as a population, Bill mentioned they're on the northern edge of the range here. But overall, nationally, northern bobwhites are really declining, and there's a lot of activities in the bird conservation arena trying to figure out how to reestablish or bring back populations of bobwhite.
It is a southern sporting bird, game bird, and so from, say, Georgia up to Missouri, a number of efforts have been made to try to reverse that trend, and it's not always been that successful.
Over the last three decades, they've declined 4% a year, and this is over a 30-year period. So you talk about 4%, 4%, 4% for 30 years, you're going to see some noticeable declines across the U.S.
We had a caller who asked if there will be a bird-watching event in Crex Meadows this fall.
Well, I'll be giving a program there on the 18th, I believe it is, of this month, where they'll be focusing on the rare species of Crex Meadows. It's going to be an all-day symposium there in the headquarters at Crex Meadows. I don't know of any organized field trips. I know there's going to be a field trip associated with this meeting on the 18th, which is a Saturday. I'll be talking about rare birds of the Barrens or of Crex Meadows. But you can go to the Crex Meadows Friends website, and they have various events listed there, including field trips. So I would visit that on site. But there will be a group of folks there talking about wolves and butterflies and birds and other things on the 18th, those species that are rare at Crex. A wonderful, probably one of our top three wildlife areas in the state.
I would also suggest for schedules to go to the Wisconsin DNR website, search Crex Meadows. You'll be able to see what's on the calendar there as well. And as long as we're on the subject, you could also go to search Horicon Marsh. Yeah. Our programs and schedules are all listed as well. Our naturalist programs are all done for the fall. So we've got a full calendar, or you could search our friend's website at horiconmarsh.org. So all those fall schedules are up for people. Lots of good stuff coming up for fall. Time to get outside, and lots of things happening around at nature centers and wildlife areas.
Absolutely. And we got Patricia here from Madison. Patricia, hi.
Hi there. Good afternoon. Our neighborhood, which is not rural, has had the privilege of having nesting owls this past year. And they produced two owlets. We started hearing the male and the females back, February or March. Now they have all left the area, but I did hear one again the other day, and I was wondering, do they mate more than once a year? And the other question was, why do the crows flock and try to chase these owls around?
Are these great horned owls, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Well, they will only have one brood. They'll just have one nesting attempt. You know, it takes the incubations longer than for some of our songbirds, and takes longer for the young to grow and become independent. And you're talking about a single nesting. The male and female may stay together the entire time of year. And the other part of the question was
about the crows.
Oh, crows. Well,
I think the crows just hate owls.
They seem as potential predators. I've seen a perched owl just reach out, and a crow gets too close, and he'll take it right out of the air with his foot. So they don't want them to be around because they see them as potential predators of the crows. Plus,
yeah, they'll go into the roost.
I think there's just something in the crow that don't like owls.
Yeah, crows harass them during the day. Owls will hunt the crows at night.
There you go. And on that note, we have to close. Boy, it's been a lot of fun. You guys do a great job, and it's always kind of fun to do this sort of in memory of Sam Robbins.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Thank you again. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Hopefully,
thank you, Larry.
Day.
Appreciate it very much. Happy Labor Day. Noel Cutright, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, one of our guests the other. Bill Volkert, wildlife educator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, stationed in Horicon Marsh. Great to have them with us. We'll have them back for sure. Coming up tomorrow, the 20th anniversary of the Ideas Network. We celebrated that actually last Friday. I was on Ben Maron's show at 5 o'clock. But we're going to talk with David Knutson about food 20 years ago versus today. And then Lowell Lackritz talks dental health. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.